had a great show with Grant Chassie hosting and getting a call in from South Africa, where the Ammons are off on a conference about business ties between Chicago and Joburg, I guess. Counterspin alternates. Last week's that wasn't aired was about legalized sports betting. So if you want to hear something about that, that's became a billion-dollar quote-unquote industry. I always hesitant when enterprises like gambling and almost anything, the medical industry, it's not an industry. All right. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers. What's the rundown? Mumia's got a archival letter that he wrote 25 years ago. I wonder if he's going through his old writings before he went to prison radio and reading them. It hasn't been really hitting them weekly like he used to in the past. He's had some setbacks. You can find out about his case from FAIR, actually. There's a short, like, 10-minute explainer of his case. A gunshot residue was not, his hands were not assessed to see whether he had shot a gun. I think there's a little rundown in Amy Goodman's commentary about Peltier, call for him being at least have his sentence commuted on humanitarian grounds, if not pardoned right out by lame duck Biden. So maybe you want to write about Peltier, maybe you want to write about Mumia Abu-Jamal as well. Then I've got queued up, and I guess I'll go in the order I've got here, Gray Zone, The Pogrom That Wasn't. There's a great counterpunch article that goes through the whys and wherefores of how we have again been sold a bill of goods about something that happened in Amsterdam, a town I'm very fond of. He does a pretty good explainer in his pretty snarky ways, Max Blumenthal. I'm anxious to hear what he's going to say about the Syrian front being opened after the settlement settlement is premature, ceasefire in Lebanon with Hezbollah. But I haven't gotten to hear that yet. Gray Zone Radio. I played something last week about one of their journalists who was in the occupied territories and was really traumatized by the way he was handled by the security forces for reporting the same thing that went out on PBS NewsHour. And I don't think they've taken any actions against them and their correspondents on the ground. And then the heretical thing is to play something that disparages Noam Chomsky a couple of days before his birthday, a week. I remember it well because it's on Pearl Harbor Day. It's also the day after my birthday, December 8th. It's me, December 9th. Or is it 7th? Is it the day before or the day after? Here I am forgetting details. But I was impressed by TUC Radio's Mariah Gallardin and her fearless programming on Time of Useful Consciousness. And she had a two-parter on with Michael Parenti, who I've heard a lot on alternative radio in the past, but not something like this. Going through the Kennedy assassination, the mother of all conspiracy theories. I dismiss the idea of conspiracy theories, and in fact, it's not a conspiracy. That conspiracy theory gambit was actually consciously developed by the CIA. If you follow that house of mirrors, when you don't want to argue the facts of an issue, you just call it a conspiracy theory. And enough people are skeptical still of the single magic bullet thesis. In 91, Parenti had a long discourse on it to a rapturous crowd. He generally has rapturous crowds because he's a very engaging speaker, but he's dissing Irwin Knoll and of the Progressive magazine and Chomsky. And I think Noam would appreciate it, probably in the spirit of open discourse and pushing the limits of allowable debate about. But we're going to get into that, the weeds of that. And I'm thinking in terms of You know, I don't go to the Manosphere. The only Joe Rogan I heard ever before he started getting quoted in regular media was when I was searching for the famous War is a Racket speech. Whenever there's a military-related holiday, I play my favorite veteran, and that's Smedley Butler. I believe he retired as a lieutenant colonel. Was a major, I don't know. He was demoted for his political activities, which is another facet of the story that I haven't investigated much. I'm talking fast because I don't have a whole lot of time. But one of the clips that I went through to put up a different clip, I ended up putting up the family, Butler family's designated clip, where they have an actor of some renown dramatize the War is a Racket speech. But I also found Joe Rogan speaking it on his show. So the point being there that conspiracy theories, there shouldn't be a gambit for dismissing something. You should argue the facts and look at the facts. And this liberal and what even conservative dismissing of things like skepticism about the Kennedy explanation from the Warren Commission is pretty arrogant on their part. Enough people know. So, and the last part is dry and economics, the dismal science. We'll return to a guy that livens it up. Dean Baker was on with Philip Maldry, my Sunday producer, but it's pretty fresh because it's talking about the economics behind the whole miasma that the U.S. economy is in. That's kind of redundant. Anyway, I'm going to kick it, and probably since I've had this soliloquy for a while here, longer than I wanted to go on, let's hear an archival Mumia Abdul-Jamal, I guess recently voiced, though.
You're listening to the text of a letter I wrote to the newspaper Workers World while I was on death row. The sickening attacks on gay people in cities across the nation recently is a reflection of the sickness that simmers at the core of the American soul. It is here that a truly perverse hatred is bred, and from here that all attacks are launched against all who are seen as other. This violence, which seems psychosexual in nature, is an attack on the self that seeks to destroy a part of the self, that threatens the self. From Matthew Shepard to Alabama, to that bloody American ground that was once the seat of the American Confederacy, Richmond, violence spawned by the dark pit of hatred and fear is unleashed by men who claim a false and twisted purity. More often than not, those who find themselves attacking gay folks violently are replaying a violence that they grew up with or that they continue to act out of against their family or children. Is it a coincidence that Richmond, the city where a black man was burned to death and decapitated, is followed several months later with the decapitation and torture of a gay man? I think not. This cruel and savage violence must be stopped, but it won't be the cops that stop it, for they are the agents of legalized state violence. The brutality that occurs in their own homes daily. The recent spate of cops who kill their wives and kids more than proves that. The people are the solution. So my thanks to the Rainbow, On the Move to Freedom, Free the Move 9. This is Mumia Abdul-Jamal.
Well spoken from the archives. And I forgot to do some business here in my soliloquy, which is to do some underwriting announcement, and I'll let Mark Nicewander read it because I have to figure out what I'm doing next here. No, I got it down. Yeah. Get your financial things together and get those grants for solar power before they go away. I tell myself regularly.
Programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and SunPower by Legacy Solar. Based in Towanda, Illinois, a proud supporter of WEFT, SunPower by Legacy Solar provides services throughout the state of Illinois, specializing in residential and commercial solar power installations. Learn more at LegacySolarPower.com or by following their Facebook page, SunPower by Legacy Solar.
This Thanksgiving, Biden should grant clemency to Leonard Peltier. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. While many brace for the return of Donald Trump to the White House, let's remember that until Monday, January 20th, Joe Biden is still president with all the power that confers. The Constitution grants the president the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, unquote, to remedy a criminal justice system riddled with faults. One strong candidate for presidential clemency, as recently called for by Amnesty International USA, is 80-year-old Anishinaabe Lakota elder Leonard Peltier, who's been incarcerated for close to half a century for a crime he maintains he did not commit. This Thanksgiving weekend, when people across the U.S. enjoy a holiday based on the myth of a shared meal between Native people of Massachusetts and the English settler colonists who would later violently displace them, President Biden should free Leonard Peltier. The case of Leonard Peltier encapsulates the modern era of indigenous resistance. After centuries of genocide launched by Christopher Columbus and expanded by successive waves of European settlers, by the 1950s, most of the surviving indigenous nations of North America had been contained in isolated and impoverished reservations. Hollywood appropriated, caricatured, and monetized the vibrant mosaic of indigenous cultures. Many Native people moved to cities seeking economic opportunity, but still face racism and discrimination. Out of this, and amidst the civil rights and other social movements of the 1960s, the American Indian Movement, or AIM, was born. In 1973, AIM went to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, where a corrupt tribal government was working in league with federal and local authorities to violently suppress a growing movement to restore traditional practices and to block extractive industries from exploiting traditional lands. More than 50 Lakota people and their allies were murdered there over a three-year period. On June 26, 1975, Leonard Peltier was present at an AIM camp on the property of a targeted family. The camp was fired upon by unknown assailants, and the AIM members returned fire. In the ensuing minutes, two FBI agents and one young AIM activist were killed. Two AIM members were later arrested for killing the agents. At trial, the jury agreed they'd fired in self-defense and acquitted them. Leonard Peltier, arrested later, was tried separately and convicted. Peltier's trial was marked by gross FBI and federal prosecutorial misconduct with the coercion of witnesses, fabricated testimony, and suppressed exculpatory evidence. When Peltier was on trial in 1976, Joe Biden, then a young U.S. senator, was a founding member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The committee was created after the explosive Church Committee hearings that investigated the unconstitutional and criminal conduct of the FBI and its COINTELPRO operations against civil rights leaders and organizations, including AIM. A global movement grew, demanding justice for Leonard Peltier. Human rights icons like South African President Nelson Mandela and Archbishop Desmond Tutu called for his release, as did one of the federal judges involved, and years later, one of the prosecutors who tried the case. Amnesty International has campaigned for Peltier's release for decades. The group recently sent a letter to President Biden reiterating their demand.
Over the decades, like Amnesty, we have been calling on administration after administration to do the right thing by Leonard. He was in hospital in June. He was in hospital again in October. It's time to give him a chance to spend his last days with his family and with his community.
Paul O'Brien, executive director of Amnesty International USA, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, in late October, President Biden traveled to the Gila River Indian community in Arizona to formally apologize for the U.S. government's treatment of indigenous children forced into boarding schools.
all told, hundreds and hundreds of federal Indian boarding schools across the country, tens of thousands of Native children entered the system. Nearly 1,000 documented Native child deaths, though the real number is likely to be much, much higher. Lost generations, culture, and language, lost trust. It's horribly, horribly wrong. It's a sin on our soul.
President Biden said. Nick Tilson, executive director of the Indigenous-led NDN Collective, responded on Democracy Now! Saying,
what this has meant and means for Indian country is that we hope that this is a beginning of an era of repair, a repair between the United States government and the indigenous people, the first people of this land. He was in the boarding schools, and he was an assistant in Wahpeton boarding school, South Dakota. Leonard Peltier and many people who became leaders in the American Indian movement were survivors of boarding school. They came out of that era, and then they resisted.
If President Biden's apology to Gila River was genuine, he could demonstrate it by commuting the sentence of Leonard Peltier. It would be a long overdue gesture to indigenous people across the U.S. for which we could all give thanks.
Yes, for Thanksgiving. I was looking for other programming about Native American issues and tying it to colonial settlerism more generally. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow, since I guess it's sort of still Thanksgiving weekend. And now, to the program that wasn't. Corporate media fails to tell the whole story. That's a Common Dreams essay on this. Amsterdam Attacks, The Politics of Collective Violence is from the counterpunch.org that I mentioned at the top. And we're going to the gray zone with Max Blumenthal. Well, I did a pretty elaborate introduction earlier and ate up some of the time. Edited this for time so I could get some more of the economics discussion. It'll be the second half hour from Dean Baker of the Center for Policy Economics and Policy Research, I guess, CEPR.net. And then before that, we'll get to incendiary stuff from Michael Parenti. He used to be here on campus. I remember when he got beat up during the Vietnam era. He has not fond memories here. Okay. And I'll say a few more words about that. But let's get to Max Blumenthal and a colleague. Last name is Wyatt, and I forget his first name. He's posted a fair amount on this issue as well on his Twitter feed, ex-Twitter, I like to call it.
We should start from the beginning, though.
Yeah.
So it was November 7th.
Thursday,
Ajax. How do you pronounce it in Dutch?
Ajax, I guess.
Ajax. The local football club from Amsterdam played Tel Aviv Maccabi. And when Tel Aviv Maccabi comes to town, chaos is likely to ensue, as it did in Athens, Greece in March, when Tel Aviv Maccabi hooligans, who were notorious for attacking leftists and Palestinians in their own country, beat an Egyptian man so badly on camera that he was hospitalized and rampaged through Athens. So they come into Amsterdam, and everybody is preparing for violence, especially them. They're determined to instigate it. Things happen, which we're going to discuss in a second. And here's how the president of the United States responded. This is the propaganda. I mean, this obviously wasn't written by Biden. He can barely form a sentence without slurring. When he sees a baby, he starts biting the baby. The anti-Semitic attacks on Israeli soccer fans in Amsterdam are despicable and echo dark moments in history when Jews were persecuted. We've been in touch with Israeli and Dutch officials and appreciate Dutch authorities' commitment to holding the perpetrators accountable. We must relentlessly fight anti-Semitism wherever it emerges. That is clearly written by his APAC handler. It's as though there was no provocation. Closer to home, we have Ro Khanna, who is one of the most progressive members of Congress, we're told. And he repeats the propaganda. I'm deeply disturbed by the attacks on Israeli civilians in Amsterdam who are simply watching a soccer game. They were simply watching a soccer game. I mean, just remember that line as we progress. Simply watching a soccer game. This ugly anti-Semitism must be condemned, and the Dutch must hold those who committed these crimes accountable. So I, responded quickly to Ro Khanna about simply watching a soccer game. No sound here. This is the Maccabi Tel Aviv hooligans. On the night before, they ran on one of two nights of them rampaging around Amsterdam. They're singing a song, "Let the IDF win, to F the Arabs." The song includes the line, "There are no schools in Gaza, there are no children left." You can see the song being sung across Israeli cities as they commit genocide. This is in Dam Square in the center of Amsterdam. So yeah, these are just peace-loving Jews who are just there to watch a soccer game. They're going to hide in their secret annex. That's basically like Anne Frank right there.
Yeah, I mean, you saw all this hysterical coverage of people talking about how they had to open their homes to poor, innocent, persecuted Jews as though they weren't, you know, insane soccer ultras who are just notorious for being hyper-violent. I wouldn't let any of those people into my house.
Well, the Dutch authorities let them into their house, and this is what happened when they were let into Ajax Stadium. There was a moment of silence for the victims of the Valencia flood, and Israelis were actually already mocking the victims, taunting them, because Spain had enacted at least partial arms embargo on Israel. And so here's the Tel Aviv Maccabi cheering section. This is a moment of silence. Utterly disgusting. And they're doing it because of the Spanish arms embargo.
Right.
They're there to show total disrespect for the continent of Europe. And then it devolved from there. Apparently, things were peaceful at the stadium. And there was a police presence at the stadium. And there was a piece in Yediot Aronot, Ynet, the Israeli publication, about how the Tel Aviv Maccabi fans walked out of the stadium. And they were just looking for peace. They were just looking for coexistence with the local residents there. Here's an excerpt from the piece. This is quoting one of their ultras, their hooligans. "We didn't know that the organized violent reaction from the other side was coming. Leaving the game, 10 Maccabi Tel Aviv fans were roaming the train, looking for a Palestinian to beat up, in their words. They didn't find one. They arrived at the central station. At first, everything was fine." Well, they were just innocent Anne Frank reenactors looking to beat up one of the Untermenschen on a train in a city that wasn't theirs. And unfortunately, they couldn't find one. Everything was fine. Then they, you know, eventually they got beat up, right?
A pogrom. A pogrom is actually, yeah.
I guess, you know, going back a little bit in our timeline, this is the day that they arrived before the game. Here's what they were doing all around central Amsterdam. Because, you know, if you go to Amsterdam, there are homes that have like anarchist squatters have taken over some homes there. It's like a part of the local culture. And they put up Palestinian flags and other flags. And these thugs were so horrified to see this that they just decided that it was their city and they could commit vandalism. And in many cases, they were permitted. And so here's them ripping down one of the flags. They proceeded to burn them as the local police chief confirmed. This is somebody's home. Just imagine if that happened in your city. And, you know, they were escorted to carry out this rampage by none other than the Mossad. So what's going on here? I mean, what was the Mossad doing, Wyatt?
Well, I would assume the Mossad was doing what they tend to do, which is to quote unquote protect the interests of Israel and Israelis abroad, which presumably means that they were there to act as kind of bodyguards and protect the Maccabi fans as they marauded through the city and on this kind of night of mayhem and tried to find Palestinians to beat up, or at the very least, anybody of some kind of Arab-looking complexion, right? I don't know what else the Mossad would have been attempting to do during all this. They certainly weren't attempting to stop any of the violence.
Yeah, I mean, they could have also been there to instrumentalize it or orchestrate it.
Right.
And I mean, as we reported, we highlighted a video by a 16-year-old YouTuber who's very popular in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, named Bender. And he documented, he was really the only member of the media on the ground for the night of violence by Maccabi Ultra thugs. And one of the things he showed that I think was really important to show was the military style operation of these thugs, how they moved in a pack of about 100. They didn't run because running leads to them dispersing, and they had clear leadership. And they were there with Israeli intelligence agents, and many of them, as we've confirmed, were members of the Israeli military, reservists who had participated in the genocide in Gaza. So we should go through some of his footage really quickly, because I mean, and tell us, you know, hold on, I have these ads, but we worked on a piece on how Bender actually documented them attacking cops.
Right. And he documented the arrest of a kid. He said they were using children that appeared to be no older than 12 to kind of as the sort of vanguard of this group of thugs, because obviously they understood that the police would let go a kid, that a young child is not going to get arrested or thrown in jail overnight. Right. So they apparently were deploying children as their human shields while they went around on this rampage throughout Amsterdam. And, you know, that's I don't know how else to interpret it. That's who was, you know, apparently detained, according to Bender, for having assaulted undercover police officers. I have no reason to doubt anything that he published. He kind of emerged as the lone journalistic voice of reason, the lone journalist who was willing to actually show what happened and then refused to back down after initially publishing it, has not retracted anything that he put out, any factually correct journalism that he produced. He's basically the only one, with the possible exception of this Dutch photojournalist, whose work was stolen by a bunch of mainstream media outlets and used to portray a totally 180-degree backwards scenario in which the Israelis were the victims. Those are the only two journalists that I'm aware of. I guess now we have the Left Laser guys that actually went and interviewed some of the victims of the Israeli violence. But other than those handful of journalists, pretty much every journalist who's written about this has emerged as either a coward, a liar, or, you know, in some cases, a plagiarist.
Yeah.
Indeed, that's a colleague of Max Blumenthal, the host of the Gray Zone Radio edit that I got it from. I guess the YouTube channel, they go on to show some of the video that this young guy Bender put up. I don't know if they go into that other material they were talking about. That's Kevin Wyatt, maybe, his colleague, who's posted on it too. Like I mentioned, Counterpunch has a great story that I think links to some of that video, as well as there's a Common Dreams article, the pogrom that didn't happen. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station, I should say. And, now we're going to even get more controversial, because this hits me where I live. This is News from Neptune. My name's Paul Muth, and it's in honor of Chomsky's work, but his work is disparaged here in a rousing talk that TUC Radio featured over the last couple of weeks. It's on Thursday, so that this second one went out on Thanksgiving. I had heard the first one and searched out the podcast version, which you can find, get the whole thing, parts one and two. And it was recorded quite a while ago, so there's a few anachronisms. Chomsky had just written the book called Rethinking Camelot, which is quoted a little in this discourse. I think it's worth. I'm extremely ambivalent, so I'm just going to let it rip. The tone that he takes is pretty outraged. I think he should be disappointed, but that's just me, and it was a different time. Again, from the TUC Radio with Mariah Gallardin, edited of his talk. I've heard a number of his talks. They're always quite good, but I'd never heard this one before. I guess that's why I want to represent at least this segment here. And it gets into the nuts and bolts of the bolt action gun, etc.
In Lee Harvey Oswald's life. In part one, Parenti went through Oswald's defection to the USSR and his public statements there about passing on military secrets, and his return to the U.S., no questions asked, with the State Department paying for his travel and moving expenses. Now he explains how Oswald is building a leftist identity. Michael Parenti.
Once back in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald settles in under the wing of one George de Morenschild, a right-wing Russian with CIA ties. And this begins a whole pattern that goes on in Dallas and New Orleans, namely, forays out into the public eye as a leftist. He starts a one-person Fair Play for Cuba organization in New Orleans, never has another member, never recruits another member. All his time in New Orleans and in Dallas, he never once contacts a single member of the Communist Party or any other left organization. Although he writes lots of letters to the Communist Party USA and to the Socialist Workers Party, two groups which at that time weren't even talking to each other. Say, dear comrades, how are you? We fight forward and we go on. Yes, what should I do? And this and that. Send me instructions, you know. He blazes a trail, local TV, fistfights, inflammatory incidents, leaflets. One of the leaflets shows that his organization was on Camp Street in the very same building that Guy Bannister had his office. Guy Bannister was an FBI agent, and a whole bunch of other Cuban emigre right-wing groups were there. And his personal relations were with right-wing anti-communist Cubans or with right-wing crypto-fascists or CIA types or others. So while he supposedly was this leftist, and if you ever heard any of the tapes of him speaking and explaining what communism was or socialism was, it's laughable. It's this little rote, superficial thing. While he was a leftist, in fact, all his personal associations were with right-wing people linked to the intelligence community. He also knew Jack Ruby. Now, they would have us believe that this man who couldn't hit the side of the barn took a Manlinka Carcana rifle, whose sights were not even set. An Italian weapon, by the way, which the Italians said, the weapon that never killed anyone on purpose. And he fired and killed the President of the United States. That he would forego shooting President Kennedy when he had a full body shot of him coming right at him down Houston Street, right toward the Texas Book Depository, where he could go at him like a shooting gallery that's coming closer and closer. Perfect, the ideal thing. He didn't shoot him then. He waited until the car turned at a 110-degree angle down Elm Street, and as he went by and had only his head and a little portion of his shoulders, and then firing through the trees, he rapidly got off three shots in a few seconds, something which the best marksmen in the country were not able to emulate until after much practice and after the sights on the Manlinka Carcana were reset and brought into a laboratory and fixed in there, and they had all sorts of remarks to make about the awful performance of this rifle. By the way, right through a tree that was later cut down. We are asked to believe that a bullet would go through John Kennedy, pose in midair for 2 seconds, change directions, and wound Governor Connally in two places, and then reappear intact on a stretcher fallen out of Connally's body. By the way, that's not true. It did not ever reappear on the stretcher as if fallen out of somebody's body. It had reappeared wedged into the side of the stretcher. It obviously had been pushed in there. So this was a bullet that jumped out of Connally's body and wedged itself in the side of the stretcher. This magic bullet had a lot of magic in it. We're asked to believe that a treasure of physical evidence, the interior of the limousine, the presidential limousine itself, which would have all sorts of evidence, bits of shrapnel, whatever else, from bullet parts, blood, lines of fire, which was just accidentally taken, instantly torn out, destroyed, and totally rebuilt, that this was not a deliberate cover-up. But we're asked to believe that Kennedy's brain just disappeared, that the X-ray, which now shows a reconstructed head with no exit wound, is oddly taken with no jaw. So it could be anybody's. You can't do any kind of dental identification to see if that X-ray is President Kennedy's. That the autopsy was just botched innocently. We're asked to believe that Jack Ruby, a gambler and gangster with links to the Cuban exiles and an acquaintance of Oswald's, who once worked for Congressman Richard Nixon for the House Un-American Activities Committee in Chicago when his name was still Jack Rubenstein, before he changed it to Ruby. We're asked to believe that he just took it upon himself to kill Oswald because he was so moved by the suffering that Oswald had caused the Kennedy family. Although Ruby, a year later in jail, repeatedly kept alluding to the fact that you don't know the whole story. There's much more behind all of this. There's something really deep and sinister here and all this. And he was just simply dismissed by a media that was taking its cues. We're asked that the 21 witnesses, persons otherwise related to the case in some close way, with some information, privy to some conversations, whatever else, all who've met violent deaths were part of a colossal coincidence, like the one the Washington Post was talking about. That later on in 1978, the second round of killings that started after the House Select Committee investigation, 16 more who died violently, they just happened to die coincidentally, violent deaths, including one of them being George de Morenchild himself, killed by a gun blast to the head 3 hours after a House Assassinations Committee investigator had tried to contact him. He was being set up for an interview. He was being set up for a lot more than that. George Morenchild was not only close to Oswald, but in his telephone book there was found an inscription, or an insert to George Pappy Bush, that he was a close friend of George Bush, and there was a correspondence between them. The sheriff's office in Palm County, Florida, found that his shooting was very strange, and it was ruled a suicide. William Sullivan, a third guy in the FBI, who was supposed to appear before the House committee to talk. By the way, Sullivan was on CIA, according to Robert Murrow, he was on the CIA payroll. He was shot right outside his home by a man who claimed to have mistaken him for a deer. He was charged with misdemeanor and released in custody of his father, a state policeman. Sam Giancano, who died from natural causes when his heart stopped beating after a bullet went through it. One day before he was to testify about mob and CIA connections while under government protection. And by the way, what comes out of this whole thing is the incredible linkages between the CIA and mob families and mob figures again and again. Because after all, the mob is very functional. They can do the kind of dirty things that the CIA may sometimes want them to do. There are even some on the left, like Noam Chomsky and Alexander Coburn, who argue that this whole interest in the assassination comes from a Kennedy revival, a Camelot yearning, the yearning for a lost messiah. I'm giving quotes. These are quotes right from Chomsky. Coburn and Chomsky and others, they challenge the notion that Kennedy was assassinated for intending to withdraw from Vietnam or undo the CIA or end the Cold War. These things could not have led to his downfall because they were not true. Kennedy was a Cold Warrior, a counterinsurgent who wanted a military withdrawal from Vietnam only with victory. I have argued similarly in my book, Democracy for the Few, that in fact, indeed, Kennedy was a Cold Warrior and a counterinsurgent, and that he should not be romanticized as a progressive. Chomsky, Coburn, and others claim that the change of administration that came with JFK's assassination had no large-scale effect on policy, not even on tactics. In other words, if Kennedy had lived, he likely would have fabricated a Tonkin Gulf casus belli. He would have introduced ground troops in a massive land war, as Lyndon Johnson did. He would have engaged in the merciless B-52 carpet bombings of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, as Richard Nixon did. He would have risked destroying his own electoral base, proving himself a mass murderer as bad as Nixon. Chomsky and Coburn don't tell us how they know that. All we know is the one surviving Kennedy, the Robert Kennedy, in fact, went a different way. He became an anti-war critic, he opposed the war, he broke with the Johnson administration, and he said that his brother's administration, his administration, had committed terrible mistakes. The evidence we do have, in fact, is that John Kennedy observed Cambodian neutrality and negotiated a ceasefire and coalition government in Laos, which the CIA refused to honor. They preferred to back a right-wing faction that continued the war. Chomsky says much about troop withdrawal. He just wrote a whole book on this, Camelot Revisited and all that. But he says very little about troop escalation, other than to offer Roger Hilsman speculation that Kennedy might well have introduced U.S. troops, ground troops, in South Vietnam. Maybe so, maybe not. In fact, the same Hilsman noted in the New York Times not long ago, and Chomsky doesn't note it, that in 1963, Kennedy was the only person in his administration who opposed the introduction of U.S. ground troops. He was the only thing preventing an escalation of the war. Forget the question of withdrawal or not withdrawal. He was a barrier in that sense. Whether or not there are certain left analysts who think Kennedy was or wasn't a progressive or a liberal and thinks that the CIA had no reason to kill him or other people had no reason to be dissatisfied with him, the fact is, do they see it that way? You know, entrenched interests are notorious for not seeing the world the same way that left analysts do.
That's for sure. That was always what I said about the Kennedy assassination. You didn't have to believe Kennedy was going to stop the war or be transformed the U.S., but if people thought he might, they might act in that way. He goes on to, and that's Michael Parenti. He was an academic here quite a few years ago, activist after that at the U of I during the Vietnam era. That was from TUC Radio. It was a two-parter. I listened to the first part a couple of weeks ago, and then the second part went out on Thursday. I found that at AudioPort, the Pacifica service. I just looked for it to see whether you could find TUC Radio on Apple Podcasts, and it didn't turn up. Some archival material from it, episode they call From the Archive, has a feature with Michael Parenti, but it's not this one. So I'm sure you can find it if you try a little harder than I had for just moments there. I commend it to your attention, and again, I'm doing it because dismissive of conspiracy theories is a strategy. One should argue the facts of the case. One shouldn't just be glib and dismiss things. There are conspiracies, and a lot of it's done out in the open. The long campaign from the Powell Committee, Powell memo on, the Lever Time did this great report, which I haven't gotten yet. It's behind a paywall, so I should give them some money, though, because I do go to lever time for their stuff, there are conspiracies like that to go ahead. So do I have enough time? No, I don't have enough time for all of Dean Baker, but we'll hear some of his insights. This is recorded last Sunday, and it's talking about the economic team that Trump is putting together, as well as some basic stuff about taxing economics, et cetera, et cetera. The hedge fund exception, where they pay so much less than people that work for their living. Going to the dismal science for the end of the show. Oh, it's played the segment about the disturbances in Amsterdam that happened before the Maccabee, Haifa, Tel Aviv Maccabee? I forget now. They did win against Betsikas, a Turkish side. It wasn't played in Turkey like it would have been. They moved it to Hungary and had it with no ultras, no fans of any kind. It was played in an empty stadium during the COVID times when I escaped to a lot of world football. Women's national team is playing the British national team, which has the extra drama of the fact that the U.S. coach is now the British woman that coached Chelsea and a bunch of women's teams in the U.K. So, a great diversion for a Saturday afternoon, much better than the brutal U.S. football that I can't stand to watch because it's cringeworthy, the injuries.
Dean Baker. Dean is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's written a lot of books. He has articles published all over the place, including Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. Dean Baker, welcome back to the Sunday Show.
Rigged is free online, by the way.
So we've gotten a whole list of people who have been named to the economic side of the administration. These are nominations, of course, and we'll see if they all pass scrutiny in the Senate confirmation process. But I guess the biggest job in the new administration here is Secretary of the Treasury, and the announcement Friday of Scott Bessent as the nominee. Scott Bessent is a billionaire. Ironically enough, he got his start in Wall Street finance working for George Soros, who is the bête noire of right-wing Republicans. And George Soros set him up with his own hedge fund about 10 years ago called Key Square Hedge Fund. In essence, he seems to be a nominee that will make Wall Street happy. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be the case. I mean, you have this bizarre mix of people with Trump where you have people who are basically totally wacky, and that's a lot of what he appealed to in his campaign. Not saying all his voters are totally wacky, but his ideas that he were pushing. So like his huge taxes on imports, which unfortunately went under the name tariffs. A lot of people don't know what a tariff is. I don't think Donald Trump knows what a tariff is, but the tax on imports. So he's running around pushing big taxes on imports, like this is going to be free money and make us all happy. And also his other big economic or whatever you want to call it idea was, of course, mass deportations. Sometimes we talk about deporting 20 million people. In addition to being a humanitarian nightmare, that also would have a huge economic impact. So these were kind of his two big economic pitches, and Bessent doesn't seem to come from the wing of the party that would support that. He is a Wall Street guy. People make too much, I think, of the, well, I don't know, people decide whether they want to make a lot of the Soros connection or not. Soros is known, not that I know the guy personally, but he's known to keep his politics very separate from his hedge fund operation. So he picks people for his hedge fund who he thinks are good for the hedge fund. What I will say about Bessent is that he did actually support Gore in 2000. Doesn't make him any big leftist or anything, but he, you know, in that sense is relatively moderate. I'll also mention he's openly gay, he's married to a man, has two adopted kids. I mean, you know, again, that doesn't necessarily mean much except in the context of a party where a lot of people want to go after gays, lesbians, transsexuals. So anyhow, in the scheme of things, he's, yes, a billionaire, Wall Street friendly, given who we get from the Trump administration, would have to be seen as a relative moderate.
So maybe we should start with something really basic, like what is a hedge fund?
That's a really good question. I remember I asked that, like, what distinguishes a hedge fund from, say, a mutual fund, and basically it's that they don't disclose anything. So hedge funds are, you know, if you or I have money in a mutual fund, a 401k where we have a mutual fund, you could look up everything they own. It's all public. That's the condition of being a mutual fund, you know, that it has to disclose. A hedge fund is basically that, but there's no disclosure requirement, so they could do pretty much anything they want. And this has been a form of investment that's really taken off in the last three decades. I'd have to go back to see when we first had something called hedge funds. I associate with the 90s. That might not be right, but it certainly has exploded. And the people run them, the partners, often, I shouldn't say always, but often become incredibly wealthy. So you mentioned the guy's a billionaire. He used to be a billionaire. It was a really rare phenomenon. But in the hedge fund world, that's not uncommon. I should also mention that the people who run hedge funds benefit. They have a special tax break, the carried interest tax deduction. So most of us, when we get paid our salary or, you know, hourly wage, whatever it is, we pay taxes on that as normal income. Hedge fund partners get special treatment. So if you manage a hedge fund, typical, again, there's all sorts of variations on this, and this is probably less common today than it was 20 years ago, but a typical payment if you managed a hedge fund was what was called a 2-in-20 arrangement, where let's say I'm managing a hedge fund with $1 billion, I get 2% off the top. So I get $20 million regardless of what it does. So if it goes through the tanks, I still get my $20 million to put in my pocket. That would be taxed as normal income. It would be taxed like salary like you or I would make. But on top of that, I get a carried interest. That in the old days was 20%. Again, I think that's less common today. But 20% of what it makes, usually against a benchmark, so against the S&P 500 or some other benchmark. It doesn't have to be that, could be anything. And that 20% was what was called the carried interest. And that was taxed at a capital gains rate. So if you're a very rich person, as someone like Mr. Besant is, that money as a capital gains rate, you'd be taxed at 20%, whereas if we're taxed as normal income today, it'd be 35%. Years past, it would have been 40%. But the point is, you're taxed at a considerably lower rate, and a lower rate than what many, say, a school teacher or firefighter, they might be in the 25% bracket. So in addition to making a lot of money, we also have a special tax break for them. And needless to say, they take advantage of that.
So in general, he has indicated that certainly the last thing that Trump wants is inflation. And so he is apparently under the impression that these tariffs can be imposed on all imported goods and the expense of those tariffs passed on to the consumer, that somehow will not be inflationary. Would you explain?
Well, it's not clear what he thinks, or for that matter, I'm not even that sure what he's been saying on that. I mean, it's basically an incoherent position. I mean, the idea, if we put a tax on barrels of oil, so we're going to have a $10 tax on, we do have a tax on barrels of oil, but suppose we raise it by $10 a barrel, I don't know anyone's going to tell you that it's not going to be largely, maybe not 100%, but largely passed on in the gas we buy. So why we would have this idea that if we put a tax on imports, it won't get passed on to consumers in a product. And we have like tons of evidence. This isn't a new story. Tariffs have been around for hundreds of years, and there's plenty of evidence. And in fact, we go back to the Trump administration. They put tariffs on a number of items, and they're passed on very close to 1-to-1. I remember I was following it. It's not my particular area of economics, but I was following it because I do follow, you know, macroeconomy and prices. And you put a tariff, I think it was on washing machines. I'm trying to remember if that was it. Anyhow, if you just looked at the consumer price index measure for that, it rose almost exactly 1-to-1. And we don't get all our washing machines from China. But the point is, if you put a 20%, whatever the tariff was, on washing machines from China, not only will those go up 20% or something close to it, but the domestic washing machines will go up in price because they realize their competitors are now charging more. They're not stupid people. In fact, that's partly the point of the tariff. You want to give them more profits, more incentive to expand production. So it is almost definitional. It's kind of like saying, suppose I raise my prices, will that be inflationary? Well, yeah, that's kind of the definition of inflation. So again, I'm quite certain he doesn't believe that you could have big tariffs and it not be inflationary. Is he going to say that to win Donald Trump's favor? Entirely possible, but I really doubt he believes that.
So the other big cabinet position that was named was Secretary of Commerce, Howard Lutnick. Howard Lutnick is a CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, another Wall Street firm. For those that go back to 2001, you might recall that almost the entire New York Wall Street staff of Cantor Fitzgerald was killed in the World Trade Center bombing. That day, Howard was, doing something with his teenage son at school or something, and wasn't at his desk when the World Trade Center fell. Howard Lutnick is a billionaire also. Maybe go into a little bit, what does Cantor Fitzgerald do, and what do you know about Howard Lutnick?
Well, Cantor Fitzgerald is also a hedge fund. They are engaged in all sorts of investments worldwide. They were involved with Saudi Arabia. There were some, to my view, crazy conspiracies about how they'd been tipped off. And most of they were tipped off. Not everyone got the tip. I'm saying they're crazy because I do think, I'm sorry, I don't think it was, you know, there was advanced knowledge of it. I think he just was very fortunate. But again, they have their hands in all sorts of things nationally, internationally. Again, I can't speak to what specific investments they hold because offhand, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure some people documented, you know, where they've been involved in a big way. You know, he's also very much a Wall Street insider. I mean, you don't get to be a billionaire in these things without being a Wall Street insider. He is less orthodox. So, you know, he is more, I believe he's more tariff friendly, I'll put it that way, than our Treasury Secretary or new or Pickford Treasury Secretary. But again, I doubt he would try to tell us that tariffs don't increase, they're not inflationary.
So bitcoins, they are now at record highs, almost 100,000 for Bitcoin. And there was a time when Trump thought that this was a bogus scheme. Now he's all on board for bitcoins. Is Litnik involved with bitcoins? What there's something called the Doge coin. What do you know about all that?
I don't know of him being Litnik being involved with Bitcoin. I mean, I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, Bitcoin's a scam. I'll just, you know, and I've referred to it as counterfeit money, and I think that's the best way to think about it. So if we have counterfeit money and get people to take it, well, good for us, bad for everyone else, but, you know, good for us. So I don't know of him having any particular involvement with Bitcoin. I think basically people on Wall Street are happy to make money off of it. So I know Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, the largest bank in the country, he'd been totally critical of Bitcoin, probably to say the exact same things I would about it. It's like, what the hell do we have it for? Why would we need it? Who would ever pay for it? It's nuts. They're now looking to get Bitcoin because they make money off of it. That's all they care about. So anyhow, in the case of Trump, he originally said it's a scam, and that was correct, but he realized that he could make money off of it. He got some big contributions from Bitcoin investors, and he said, oh yeah, we should have a strategic reserve of Bitcoin. And in fact, he now has some, there's some Trump, I don't know if it's a coin or I forget what it is, but they're actually actively scamming with Bitcoin. And the price of Bitcoin has soared like around 50% since he was elected. He's been talking about having a strategic reserve of Bitcoin. I don't know what the hell he thinks that means. Just basically, it means handing money to the people who already own Bitcoin. That's kind of the bottom line. So it's, as I say, it's absolute craziness. But again, this is, you know, the Trump policy. Basically, they're saying as openly as they can, we're scamming the country. They're saying, give us money and we'll reward you with policies that favor us. So give money to the campaign, give money to me personally. They're not doing any of the disclosures. They went through some pretext of complying with conflict of interest laws in 216. He's saying, I'm not doing that. I'm just going to scam, you know, and we'll see how much they, you know, they'll probably steal a lot. I mean, I think if you run on that as your platform, I think we should assume he intends to do it.
So the whole situation is now back to where we started with this tax cut. And it's supposed to sunset next year, and now with Trump back in, it's obviously not going to sunset. Tell us who benefited from the tax cut exactly what it means that it will no doubt be renewed.
Well, the biggest part of it, and that gets overshadowed because it's not up for renewal, that's the corporate tax cut. So we lowered the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, which was obviously a very large cut in tax. Now, in fairness, we weren't collecting 35%. We were collecting around 21%, 22% of corporate profits because there were so many loopholes. And one of the things that some people said in this administration to sell it was that we're going to lower the rates, but we'll actually collect that. We'll actually get, you know, something close to 21%. No one expects you to get exactly the 21% rate, but something close to that. And I'm actually sympathetic to that. I mean, if you're only collecting 21, 22%, but your tax rate's 35%, doesn't it make more sense just to lower the rate and actually collect something close to it? And I'd be inclined to agree. I mean, I'd rather have a higher rate, you know, let's get 25, 28% or something, but whatever. You know, there's no point in having a high tax that no one's paying. But anyhow, so they cut it, and not only did they cut the rate, but they left the loopholes in. So we're getting somewhere around 13% if you go back to 2018-19, the years immediately after the tax cut. Now, interestingly, Biden got that up some. I attribute that mostly to increased enforcement. They actually took enforcing the tax law seriously. But anyhow, that's a corporate tax. That's not on the agenda because those cuts were permanent. So they're not up for renewal. But what is up for renewal is the income tax parts. And that was a reshuffling. And for most middle-income people, it didn't make much difference. Some people were better off. Some people were worse off. It was designed to screw people in blue states. And they say that. So they limited the tax deduction for state and local taxes. They had some other provisions that were, you know, fairly explicitly designed to hurt people in blue states. So places like California and New York with high income taxes, high property taxes. They limited the mortgage interest tax deduction. Again, it matters much more in California where, I don't know what your median home price is these days, $700,000 or whatever. But anyhow, it matters much more in a state like California than, you know, in Indiana or Kentucky where homes are cheap. So anyhow, they put in restrictions that were designed to hurt people in blue states, help people in red states. But for most middle-income people, it did not change their tax liability to any great extent. It did for higher-income people. So they lowered the tax rate 39.6% to 35%. And now it's really at issue because Biden and then Harris said that they would leave in place the tax cuts or tax changes for low and middle income people. So the line was if you earn less than $400,000 a year or income's less than $400,000 a year, no change. So we're arguing about the taxes on people earning over $400,000 a year. It's around 1%, give or take, of all households. And they want to maintain the big cuts for them. It'll cost hundreds of billions a year. Whereas Biden or then Harris would have eliminated those. So that's really what the fight's over. They just said, okay, we want to extend the tax breaks for people under 400K. No arguments. There, you know, you could quibble over, you know, do you want to keep the SALT deduction or change it? You know, that would be something that you could argue over. But there's bipartisan agreement on keeping in place the tax changes put in place in 2017.
I am Philip Muldery. My guest is Dean Baker, Senior Economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Their website is cepr.net, cepr.net, where you can find more information about Dean and his colleagues. We are going to open the phones in about 15, 20 minutes. Elon Musk has carved out his own particular job in the upcoming Trump administration as the guy that's going to reduce fraud, waste, and abuse and save huge amounts, gazillions of dollars in the upcoming administration. I guess he attacked having to pay the interest on the debt, which would seem like not the smartest thing to go after if you're supposedly looking for fraud and abuse.
You know, he just seems astounding. Yeah, obviously he's tremendously wealthy and all that. You know the line, well, he must be real smart because he's so rich. I hear that flipped over. If you're so rich, how come you're not smart? He doesn't seem to know anything about the federal budget. I don't mean like he's not a budget wonk who's got his nose in the details. He doesn't seem to know the basic things. Okay, I'd rather we didn't pay $900 billion a year in interest. That would be nice. How do you stop? Are we just say the U.S. government's going to default on its debt? There'd be serious repercussions from that. Like our whole economy, the whole financial structure would be shaken because that's kind of the bedrock of not just the U.S. financial system, but the world financial system. So we're just going to stop. Again, does he really think that? I have no idea. He said he's going to reduce the spending by $2 trillion. Well, that's roughly a little less than a third of the federal budget. Most of what we pay out, interest, military, Social Security, and Medicare, that's probably 70-80%. I'd have to get the exact number. But you can't eliminate a third of the budget in anything resembling waste. You can cut back Social Security, Medicare. A lot of people are very dependent on that, and they're also very popular programs. And Trump ran around everywhere saying, oh, I'll never touch them. So I don't know what he thinks. Everything about this is kind of a joke. He's calling it Department of Governmental Efficiency. It's not a department. I mean, call anything you want. I call myself the King of France. It doesn't make me King of France. He's not running a department. He's running whatever the hell he wants to call it, but it's not a department. A department has an official meaning. It's created by Congress. He doesn't have a department. He wants to look for government waste. I'll give him a great one. Manned space program, tremendously wasteful. We get so much more on a per dollar basis from unmanned space exploration, the Hubble telescope, the Webb telescope. That's tremendous waste. Now, a lot of that goes into Elon Musk's pocket. So,
yeah, and it's polluting the coast of Texas, too. All right. Dean Baker, talking a little faster than he does in everyday life. But that was from The Sunday Show, which you can find at kpfa.org if you want to hear some more of his economic insights, and cepr.net, where Mark Weisbrot, friend of this ground also, he's co-founder with Dean Baker. Philip Muldery on the interview. The conversation, time for me to say opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station, any part or total, board of trustees, whatever they are, board of directors, associates. Thanks for listening. Keep supporting community media now more than ever. Here's a little underwriting announcement from a local business, and the chess club hasn't taken my offer to start advertising here, but maybe the Go Club will. Thanks for joining, and pretty soon, I haven't mentioned Radio Free Labor, kicking it quite right after I put a sock in it here.
This hour of programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by the Canopy Club, hosting live music and events within